The Doctrine of Fascism by Benito Mussolini, Part 2. First of all, as regards the future development of mankind, and quite apart from all present political considerations, fascism does not, generally speaking, believe in the possibility or utility of perpetual peace. It therefore discards pacifism as a cloak for cowardly supine renunciation in contradistinction to self-sacrifice. War alone keys up all human energies to their maximum tension and sets the seal of nobility on those peoples who have the courage to face it. All other tests are substitutes, which never place a man face to face with himself before the alternative of life or death. Therefore, all doctrines which postulate peace at all costs are incompatible with fascism. Equally foreign to the spirit of fascism, even if accepted as useful in meeting special political situations, are all internationalistic or league superstructures, which, as history shows, crumble to the ground whenever the heart of nations is deeply stirred by sentimental, idealistic, or practical considerations. Fascism carries this anti-pacifistic attitude into the life of the individual. I don't care a damn, me ne frigo, the proud motto of the fighting squads, scrawled by a wounded man on his bandages, is not only an act of philosophic stoicism, it sums up a doctrine which is not merely political. It is evidence of a fighting spirit which accepts all risks. It signifies a new style of Italian life. The fascist accepts and loves life. He rejects and despises suicide as cowardly. Life, as he understands it, means duty, elevation, conquest. Life must be lofty and full. It must be lived for oneself, but above all, for others, both near and far off, present and future. The population policy of the regime is the consequence of these premises. The fascist loves his neighbour, but the word neighbour does not stand for some vague and unseizable conception. Love of one's neighbour does not exclude necessary educational severity. Still less does it exclude differentiation and rank. Fascism will have nothing to do with universal embraces. As a member of the community of nations, it looks other peoples straight in the eyes. It is vigilant and on its guard. It follows others in all their manifestations and notes any changes in their interests. And it does not allow itself to be deceived by mutable and fallacious appearances. Such a conception of life makes fascism the resolute negation of the doctrine underlying so-called scientific and Marxian socialism. The doctrine of historic materialism, which would explain the history of mankind in terms of the class struggle and by changes in the processes and instruments of production, to the exclusion of all else. That the vicissitudes of economic life, discoveries of raw materials, new technical processes and scientific inventions have their importance, no one denies, but that they suffice to explain human history to the exclusion of other factors is absurd. Fascism believes now and always in sanctity and heroism, that is to say, in acts in which no economic motive, remote or immediate, is at work. Having denied historic materialism, which sees in men mere puppets on the surface of history, appearing and disappearing on the crest of the waves, while in the depths real directing forces move and work, fascism also denies the immutable and irreparable character of the class struggle, which is the natural outcome of this economic conception of history. Above all, it denies that the class struggle is the preponderating agent in social transformations. Having thus struck a blow at socialism in the two main points of its doctrine, all that remains of it is the sentimental aspiration, old as humanity itself, towards social relations in which the sufferings and sorrows of the humbler folk will be alleviated. But here again, fascism rejects the economic interpretation of felicity as something to be secured socialistically, almost automatically, at a given stage of economic evolution, when all will be assured a maximum of material comfort. Fascism denies the materialistic conception of happiness as a possibility and abandons it to the economists of the mid-18th century. This means that fascism denies the equation well-being equals happiness, which sees in men mere animals, content when they can feed and fatten, thus reducing them to a vegetative existence pure and simple. After socialism, fascism trains its guns on the whole block of democratic ideologies and rejects both their premises and their practical applications and implements. Fascism denies that numbers, as such, can be the determining factor in human society. It denies the right of numbers to govern by means of periodical consultations. It asserts the irremediable and fertile and beneficent inequality of men, who cannot be levelled by any such mechanical and extrinsic device such as a universal suffrage. Democratic regimes may be described as those under which the people are, from time to time, deluded into the belief that they exercise sovereignty. While all the time, real sovereignty resides in and is exercised by other and sometimes irresponsible and secret forces. Democracy is a kingless regime, infested by many kings who are sometimes more exclusive, tyrannical, and destructive than one, even if he be a tyrant. This explains why fascism, although for contingent reasons it was republican in tendency prior to 1922, abandoned that stand before the March on Rome, convinced that the form of government is no longer a matter of preeminent importance, and because the study of past and present monarchies and past and present republics shows that neither monarchy nor republic can be judged sub specie aeternitatis, but that each stands for a form of government expressing the political evolution, the history, the traditions, and the psychology of a given country. Fascism has outgrown the dilemma of monarchy versus republic, over which democratic regimes too long dallied, attributing all insufficiencies to the former, and proning the latter as a regime of perfection. Whereas experience teaches that some republics are inherently reactionary and absolutist, while some monarchies accept the most daring political and social experiments. In one of his philosophic meditations, Renan, who had pre-fascistic intuitions, remarks, quote, "Reason and science are the products of mankind, but it is chimerical to seek reason directly for the people and through the people. It is not essential to the existence of reason that all should be familiar with it, and even if all had to be initiated, this could not be achieved through democracy, which seems fated to lead to the extinction of all arduous forms of culture and all highest forms of learning. The maxim that society exists only for the well-being and freedom of the individuals composing it does not seem to be in conformity with nature's plans, which care only for the species and seem ready to sacrifice the individual. It is much to be feared that the last word of democracy thus understood, and let me hasten to add that it is susceptible of a different interpretation, would be a form of society in which a degenerate mass would have no thought beyond that of enjoying the ignoble pleasures of the vulgar." Close quote. In rejecting democracy, fascism rejects the absurd conventional lie of political equalitarianism, the habit of collective irresponsibility, the myth of felicity and indefinite progress. But if democracy be understood as meaning a regime in which the masses are not driven back to the margin of the state, and then the writer of these pages has already defined fascism as an organized, centralized, authoritarian democracy. Fascism is definitely and absolutely opposed to the doctrines of liberalism, both in the political and the economic sphere. The importance of liberalism in the 19th century should not be exaggerated for present-day polemical purposes, nor should we make of one of the many doctrines which flourished in that last century a religion for mankind for the present and for all time to come. Liberalism really flourished for 15 years only. It arose in 1830 as a reaction to the Holy Alliance, which tried to force Europe to recede further back than 1789. It touched its zenith in 1848, when even Pius IX was a liberal. Its decline began immediately after that year. If 1848 was a year of light and poetry, 1849 was a year of darkness and tragedy. The Roman Republic was killed by a sister republic, that of France. In that same year, Marx, in his famous Communist Manifesto, launched the gospel of socialism. In 1851, Napoleon III made his illiberal coup d'etat and ruled France until 1870, when he was turned out by a popular uprising following one of the severest military defeats known to history. The victor was Bismarck, who never even knew the whereabouts of liberalism and its prophets. It is symptomatic that throughout the 19th century, the religion of liberalism was completely unknown to so highly civilized a people as the Germans, but for one parenthesis, which has been described as the ridiculous Parliament of Frankfurt, which lasted for just one season. Germany attained her national unity outside liberalism and in opposition to liberalism, a doctrine which seems foreign to the German temperament, essentially monarchical, whereas liberalism is the historic and logical anteroom to anarchy. The three stages in the making of German unity were the three wars of 1864, 1866, and 1870, led by such liberals as Moltke and Bismarck. And in the upbuilding of Italian unity, liberalism played a very minor part when compared to the contribution made by Mazzini and Garibaldi, who were not liberals. But for the intervention of the illiberal Napoleon III, we should not have had Lombardy. And without that of the illiberal Bismarck at Sadoa and at Sedan, very probably we should not have had Venetia in 1866, and in 1870 we should not have entered Rome. The years going from 1870 to 1915 cover a period which marked, even in the opinion of the high priests of the new creed, the twilight of their religion, attacked by decadentism in literature and by activism in practice. Activism, that is to say, nationalism, futurism, fascism. The liberal century, after piling up innumerable Gordian knots, tried to cut them with the sword of the World War. Never has any religion claimed so cruel a sacrifice. Were the gods of liberalism thirsting for blood? Now, liberalism is preparing to close the doors of its temples, deserted by the peoples who feel that the agnosticism it professed in the sphere of economics and the indifferentism of which it has given proof in the sphere of politics and morals would lead the world to ruin in the future as they have done in the past. This explains why all the political experiments of our day are anti-liberal, and it is supremely ridiculous to endeavour on this account to put them outside the pale of history, as though history were a preserve set aside for liberalism and its adepts, as though liberalism were the last word in civilization beyond which no one can go. The fascist negation of socialism, democracy, and liberalism should not, however, be interpreted as implying a desire to drive the world backwards to positions occupied prior to 1789, a year commonly referred to as that which opened the demo-liberal century. No, history does not travel backwards. The fascist doctrine has not taken De Master as its prophet. Monarchical absolutism is of the past, and so is ecclesiolatry. Dead and done for are feudal privileges and the division of society into closed, uncommunicating castes. Neither has the fascist conception of authority anything in common with that of a police-ridden state. A party governing a nation totalitarianly is a new departure in history. There are no points of reference, nor of comparison. From beneath the ruins of liberal, socialist and democratic doctrines, fascism extracts those elements which are still vital. It preserves what may be described as the acquired facts of history, and it rejects all else. That is to say, it rejects the idea of a doctrine suited to all times and to all people. Granted that the 19th century was the century of socialism, liberalism and democracy, this does not mean that the 20th century must also be the century of socialism, liberalism and democracy. Political doctrines pass, but nations remain. We are free to believe that this is a century of authority, a century tending to the right, a fascist century. If the 19th century was a century of the individual, liberalism implies individualism. We are free to believe that this is the collective century, and therefore the century of the state. It is quite logical for a new doctrine to make use of the still vital elements of other doctrines. No doctrine was ever born quite new and bright and unheard of. No doctrine can boast absolute originality. It is always connected, if only historically, with those which preceded it and those which will follow it. Thus, the scientific socialism of Marx links up to the utopian socialism of the Fourier, the Owen, the St. Simons. Thus, the liberalism of the 19th century traces its origin back to the illuministic movement of the 18th and the doctrines of democracy to those of the encyclopedists. All doctrines aim at directing the activities of men towards a given objective. But these activities, in their turn, react on the doctrine, modifying and adjusting it to new needs, or outstripping it. A doctrine must, therefore, be a vital act and not a verbal display. Hence the pragmatic strain in fascism, its will to power, its will to live, its attitude towards violence, and its value. The keystone of the fascist doctrine is its conception of the state, of its essence, its functions, and its aims. For fascism, the state is absolute, individuals and groups relative. Individuals and groups are admissible insofar as they come within the state. Instead of directing the game and guiding the material and moral progress of the community, the liberal state restricts its activities to recording results. The fascist state is wide awake and has a will of its own. For this reason, it can be described as ethical. At the first quinquennial assembly of the regime in 1929, I said, quote, "The fascist state is not a night watchman, solicitous only of the personal safety of the citizens. Nor is it organized exclusively for the purpose of guaranteeing a certain degree of material prosperity and relatively peaceful conditions of life. A board of directors could do as much. Neither is it exclusively political, divorced from practical realities and holding itself aloof from the multifarious activities of the citizens and the nation. The state, as conceived and realized by fascism, is a spiritual and ethical entity for securing the political, juridical and economic organization of the nation. An organization which in its origin and growth is a manifestation of the spirit. The state guarantees the internal and external safety of the country, but it also safeguards and transmits the spirit of the people, elaborated down the ages in its language, its customs and its faith. The state is not only the present, it is also the past, and above all, the future. Transcending the individual's brief spell of life, the state stands for the imminent conscience of the nation. The forms in which it finds expression change, but the need for it remains. The state educates the citizens to civism, makes them aware of their mission, urges them to unity. Its justice harmonizes their divergent interests. It transmits to future generations the conquests of the mind in the fields of science, art, law, human solidarity. It leads men up from primitive tribal life to that highest manifestation of human power, imperial rule. The state hands down to future generations the memory of those who lay down their lives to ensure its safety or to obey its laws. It sets up as examples and records for future ages the names of the captains who enlarged its territory and of the men of genius who have made it famous. Whenever respect for the state declines and the disintegrating and centrifugal tendencies of individuals and groups prevail, nations are headed for decay. Close quote. Since 1929, economic and political development have everywhere emphasized these truths. The importance of the state is rapidly growing. The so-called crisis can only be settled by state action and within the orbit of the state. Where are the shades of the Jules Simons, who in the early days of liberalism proclaimed that the, quote, state should endeavour to render itself useless and prepare to hand in its resignation, close quote. Or of the McCullochs, who in the second half of last century urged that the state should desist from governing too much. And what of the English Bentham, who considered that all industry asked of government was to be left alone, and of the German Humboldt, who expressed the opinion that the best government was a lazy one? What would they say now to the unceasing, inevitable, and urgently requested interventions of government in business? It is true that the second generation of economists was less uncompromising in this respect than the first, and that even Adam Smith left the door ajar, however cautiously, for government intervention in business. If liberalism spells individualism, fascism spells government. The fascist state is, however, a unique and original creation. It is not reactionary, but revolutionary, for it anticipates the solution of certain universal problems, which have been raised elsewhere, in the political field by the splitting up of parties, by the usurpation of power by parliaments, the irresponsibility of assemblies, in the economic field by the increasingly numerous and important functions discharged by trade unions and trade associations, with their disputes and ententes, affecting both capital and labour, in the ethical field by the need felt for order, discipline, obedience to the moral dictates of patriotism. Fascism desires the state to be strong and organic, based on broad foundations of popular support. The fascist state lays claim to rule in the economic field no less than in others. It makes its action felt throughout the length and breadth of the country by means of its corporative, social, and educational institutions, and all the political, economic, and spiritual forces of the nation, organized in their respective associations, circulate within the state. A state based on millions of individuals who recognize its authority, feel its action, and are ready to serve its ends is not the tyrannical state of a medieval lordling. It has nothing in common with the despotic states existing prior to or subsequent to 1789. Far from crushing the individual, the fascist state multiplies his energies. Just as in a regiment, a soldier is not diminished but multiplied by the number of his fellow soldiers, the fascist state organizes the nation, but it leaves the individual adequate elbow room. It has curtailed useless or harmful liberties while preserving those which are essential. In such matters, the individual cannot be the judge, but the state only. The fascist state is not indifferent to religious phenomena in general, nor does it maintain an attitude of indifference to Roman Catholicism, the special positive religion of Italians. The state has not got a theology, but it does have a moral code. The fascist state sees in religion one of the deepest of spiritual manifestations, and for this reason it not only respects religion, but defends and protects it. The fascist state does not attempt, as did Robespierre, at the height of the revolutionary delirium of the Convention, to set up a god of its own, nor does it vainly seek, as does Bolshevism, to efface God from the soul of man. Fascism respects the God of ascetics, saints, and heroes, and it also respects God as conceived by the ingenious and primitive heart of the people, the God to whom their prayers are raised. The fascist state expresses a will to exercise power and to command. Here, the Roman tradition is embodied in a conception of strength. Imperial power, as understood by the fascist doctrine, is not only territorial or military or commercial, it is also spiritual and ethical. An imperial nation, that is to say, a nation which directly or indirectly is a leader of others, can exist without the need of conquering a single square mile of territory. Fascism sees in the imperialistic spirit, i.e. in the tendency of nations to expand, a manifestation of their vitality. In the opposite tendency, which would limit their interests to the home country, it sees a symptom of decadence. Peoples who rise or re-arise are imperialistic. Renunciation is characteristic of dying peoples. The fascist doctrine is at best suited to the tendencies and feelings of a people which, like the Italian, after lying fallow during centuries of foreign servitude, are now reasserting itself in the world. But imperialism implies discipline, the coordination of efforts, a deep sense of duty, and a spirit of self-sacrifice. This explains many aspects of the practical activity of the regime, and the direction taken by many of the forces of the state, as also the severity which has to be exercised towards those who would oppose this spontaneous and inevitable movement of 20th century Italy by agitating outgrown ideologies of the 19th century. Ideologies rejected wherever great experiments in political and social transformations are being dared. Never before have the peoples thirsted for authority, direction, and order as they do now. If each age has its doctrine, then innumerable symptoms indicate that the doctrine of our age is the fascist. That it is vital is shown by the fact that it has aroused a faith. That this faith has conquered souls is shown by the fact that fascism can point to its fallen heroes and its marches. Fascism has now acquired throughout the world that which universally belongs to all doctrines, that which, by achieving self-expression, represent a moment in the history of human thought.